I remember. A painter. Blonde, very gentle. He was here. But he's gone now. I'm his brother. She looked at me with quick unease, plucked at the pocket of her overall. Where's his house, le pigeonnier, madame? In the village or outside? She closed the ledger before her, avoiding my look. No, it's not in the village, no. On the road to Saint-Basile, about 2 kilometres. I haven't been there, but I know that it's empty. No one is there now. I thanked her and went across to the bar. I knew that she was watching me, knew that she was standing perfectly still, pondering.
Jericho was written and read by Dirk Bogard. It was abridged by Neville Teller. The producer was Janet Whittaker. And the story continues tomorrow afternoon at 2:30.
The Digital Station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now on 4 Extra, it's time for The Tent, The Bucket and Me. Written and read by Emma Kennedy. In 1970, the 3-year-old Emma Kennedy and her parents, Brenda and Tony, took their first family holiday. It featured a tent and a bucket and an awful lot of Welsh rain. And a bit of Lee Marvin, apparently.
It's 1970. I'm 3 years old, I've got a pudding bowl of white blonde hair, and we're about to go on our first family holiday. There was no doubt about it. We were excited. Our holiday destination was Solva, a small coastal village on the St David's Peninsula in West Wales. Not only would my paternal grandmother be coming with us, we would be travelling in a resprayed grey Wolseley and sleeping in a newly acquired tent. Bursting with something primeval and masculine, my dad clutched the steering wheel with the confidence of a hunter-gatherer and sang songs loudly as if he was at a rugby match. I didn't know it yet, but every holiday we went on would be accompanied by that year's family song, a tune from the charts that we would all belt out with a sense of gay abandon. This year, it would be Wandering Star, sung by Lee Marvin from the film Paint Your Wagon. It didn't matter that my parents sounded awful. There was a sense of adventure in the air, and it smelled wonderful. Which is more than could be said for the dead sheep that I encountered during one of our many toilet stops on the way. We successfully collected my grandmother from the Rhondda Valley and headed for Pembrokeshire. As we passed the boundary into Solva, a fat, juicy drop of rain exploded onto the windscreen. Dark clouds had been gathering, and although it was only 5 o'clock in the afternoon, a dread gloom had descended. A wind, sweeping in from the Irish Sea, was prowling over the cliff tops. The campsite was little more than a field sloping off towards a cliff edge. On one side, there were a few caravans on bricks, permanent fixtures, ever hopeful that someone might want to breathe life into their damp, musty frames. The rain was now lashing down in sheets. My dad had made a dash for a wooden hut that looked as if it might have someone in it. It didn't. It was locked. "I can't find anyone," he said, wiping the wet from his eyes. "I guess we should just pick a spot and get the tent up." Whilst my dad battled with the tent, my grandmother, deciding that my mother and I needed our minds taken off the fact that this was our holiday, kept us going with wartime tales. "Then there was the time," she said, tapping a finger on her knee, "when the Germans bombed the munitions factories in Cardiff, and one of the bombers went off course and dropped his bombs on the valley. 12 people killed. Terrible it was. And because everyone was so sad with it, they decided to have the funerals all on the same day. Now,
The only vehicle available to carry all 12 coffins was the Corona Pop lorry. All stacked up they were in the back. But the thing was, when the pop van brought the coffins up the valley, people didn't know whether to laugh or cry. You know why?
Silence.
Because the slogan for Corona Pop, which was written in massive letters on the tailboards, was cheaper by the dozen. Oh, terrible. Cheaper by the dozen. Just terrible. Because there was 12 of them, see? Which is a dozen. Oh, imagine not noticing a thing like that.
I saw a dead sheep today, Grandma, I said, out of the blue.
You never did, said my grandmother with alarming urgency. Oh, that's not good. They say it's bad luck to see a dead sheep on a day of travel. Not good. Not good at all.
Meanwhile, against all the odds, Dad had got the tent up. The dash to the tent felt dangerous, even though it was no more than a few feet. The rain was whipping down, and each drop landed with a sting. My dad looked out through the tent door at the screaming weather. Can't stay like this for long, he said with a hopeful nod. It'll be blue skies in half an hour if we just wait for a bit.
You must be mad, said Mam, all matter of fact.
Then throwing me a look,
this'll last for days. She saw a dead sheep.
Everyone turned and stared at me, and somewhere in the distance, there was a low rumble of thunder. I need a wee, said my mother with a sigh, and a cup of tea.
Here you are, said my dad,
handing my mother the pink plastic bucket. What's this? Said Brenda, staring at it.
Toilet, muttered Dad,
who then unfolded four chairs and placed them in a line. You want me to piss in this while you all sit there and watch? Asked Brenda. What am I? The evening's entertainment?
Well, we'll go and stand in the bedroom compartment and look the other way. That's what we'll do. Come on, Mam. Let's go. We'll let Mammy have a wee. Come on. I need to go as well, announced Mam as we trooped off to the other side of the tent. Right, said Dad, then you can go second and I may as well, so I'll go third. Do you want to have a go?
He looked down at me. I nodded. Good, he declared, as if this was going very well.
Well, that's that sorted.
I was quite determined to take my turn on my own, so when my mother asked me if I could manage, I was adamant that I could. The pink bucket, now sloshing with three layers of urine, was perched in the darkest corner of the tent. I'd made sure that everyone was not only in the bedroom compartment, but zipped in as well. This was a solo flight, and I would complete my ablutions unassisted. My parents, sensing, in the absence of any other sort of holiday-based fun, that this was an opportunity to humour me, were happy to play along.
Don't look, Daddy!
I shouted as I negotiated my path towards the bucket. I'd never weed in a bucket before, so as I took down my tights and pants, I had a quick negotiating peek. Clearly, I could just sit on it, like a toilet. So I did. But my three-year-old body was smaller than the bucket's circumference, and the next thing I knew, I was concertinaed, knees thrown up and squashed against my chest, and I was sinking, slowly, towards two generations of excretions. I let out a small yelp. The sort of yelp that cubs stuck down wells might make. Oh, Christ, I heard my mother yell. I was still clinging to the idea that this was something I could deal with. So as I heard the compartment zip being frantically ripped upwards, I made a surge using both my arms and legs. It was a terrible error. The bucket, teetering on uneven ground, rode with my body weight and tipped itself over to one side. Warm liquid flooded up under my cardigan and gushed down my arm.
What are we going to do? Wailed my father. We've got no water to wash it.
My mother, thinking quickly, came to an obvious conclusion. We'll have to use the rain. She'll have to go out and stand in the rain. That's all we can do. Take her clothes off. Emma, you're going to have to run round the car as quickly as you can, and the rain will wash you clean, and I want you to rub yourself as hard as you can as you're going, yes? I was cold and naked. I looked out into the sheet of freezing wet. The Wolsey was so battered with rain that it was disappearing into its own halo of spray. Grass was turning to mud, and brooks of water were bubbling down and away. The last thing I wanted to do was run out into it. But whatever this short, sharp shock was going to offer, it was still better than being covered with the sticky byproducts of my family's kidneys. The rain was like ice. As I ran, mud exploding up my legs, I clung onto myself and rubbed. Emerging from behind the car, I dashed for the open door of the tent. My dad was holding a large towel like a safety net, and as I ran in, he caught me and scooped me up. "Well," said my Welsh grandmother, as she pulled a jumper over my head and my mother rubbed my legs. "It could have been worse. I could have had a poop." 3 hours later, and the weather still raged. My father had to concede that things were not as they should be. "Look, I've been thinking. What about if I try and break into one of the caravans? I don't know about you, but I'll feel a bit safer." Unzipping the tent door, the storm hit us straight on. The wind was now so fierce that it was almost impossible to walk. Picking me up, my mother held me close, folding me into the crook of her shoulder. I looked forward to see my father jimmying open the large back window of one of the caravans. Pushing himself up with his arms, he slid inside and disappeared from view, only to reappear moments later at the caravan door. The caravan, which we had hoped would be an oasis of calm, was instead a stinking hole. There was mould on the walls, a strange, troubling yet indefinable smell, like bad eggs spliced with fish guts. And worst of all, wind was piping up through the kitchen sink plug hole with a haunting, devil-made screech. The pipe-based wailing was the final straw for my grandmother, who was now slumped on a bench seat next to the window. "This," she declared, raising a finger into the air, "this is more than an act of God. Someone has brought this upon us." "Here, ma'am," said Tony, wiping mud off his face with a tea towel. "You didn't bring any of that Ouija board nonsense with you, did you?" And as he said those fateful words, the back window, which he had climbed through to give us shelter, blew in. Wind howled through the caravan, punching everything in its path. My mother, who had been bent over by the sink, was now clinging onto its edge, hair streaming back from her face. Mam was on her knees on the floor, and Tony was grabbing a foam bench seat and fighting to get to the window, which was now hanging on by a single hinge. I was pinned against the toilet door, splayed by the weather. Everyone's voices had been swallowed up by the wind. Tony, drenched and desperate, battled with the window, but the wind had the better of him. Brenda, realising that this might be an all-hands-to-the-pump situation, careered forwards, just as Mam, throwing down her handbag because it was that serious, surged to grab at the window. The force of three adults clattering to one end of the caravan was catastrophic. Everything lurched forwards, and with a tree-cracking shudder, the front end of the caravan came off its bricks. Everyone was thrown to the floor. "Get out!" Tony cried, pushing Mam up to a standing position. "Get out! Everyone get out!" The caravan was creaking with such menace that blind terror took hold. There was no doubt in any of our minds. Get out of the caravan or die. Pulling me hard behind her, Mum shoved at the caravan door. "Hold on to me tight," she yelled, looping an arm around my waist. The caravan was now at such a severe angle that the drop looked terrifying. We leapt into the rain, rolling onto the floor as we landed. Dad jumped out after us, turned and held out his hands towards Mam, poised in the doorframe and gripping either side to stop the inevitable slide back to the front of the caravan. "Jump, Mam, jump!" yelled my father, gesturing wildly. And with one heaving leap, Mam launched herself into the air and towards my father, who had his arms out and was ready to catch her. The caravan groaned. A deep crunch shattered out from its underbelly. With one terrifying yaw, the rear creaked up to the vertical, flipped over, and then rolled end over end, crashing down the field, metallic smashes punching through the howling wind. Then with one sliding finale, the caravan fell off the edge of the cliff. My grandmother never came on holiday with us again.
The Tent, the Bucket and Me was written and read by Emma Kennedy, and it was abridged and produced by Jill Waters. It's a Waters Partnership production for the BBC, and the story continues tomorrow at 3:15.
The Comedy Club at the Edinburgh Fringe.
The arms of the Edinburgh Fringe are embracing me, caressing me, and in fact have nearly crushed me to death now. I'm going back home soon. However, there is still life left amongst the youngsters who remain, including Beardy Man. Now, Beardy Man, I know in your show you have the Beardytron, and today we have you just as yourself, but you can still do loads of different voices. But I've got my own computer-generated thing, which is the Ballon Bot. I don't know if you know it. It generates questions arbitrarily. And what I'd like you to do is to see if perhaps you could find a way of accompanying this series of piercing interrogations that the Ballon Bot generates arbitrarily. Right, see what you can do. Good luck.
Hello, Ballon Bot.
Hello there. What is your name?
My name is Beardy Man.
Sing for the Ballon Bot.
I can't wait for the robots to take over. They are so much more efficient. I want to...
Yeah.
All right, fine. Interrupt me then, rude.
Shh. Shut up.
You're a rude robot, aren't you?
Sing for the Ballon Bot.
Okay, I will sing for the Ballon Bot.
Who are you scared of?
I'm scared of the robots.
Do you like pickled vegetables?
Yes.
If you could have a superpower, what would you choose?
Flying.
Why not?
Yeah.
Ha 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 ha! You're very funny. Do you want a flyer?
No, thanks. That killed it, mentioning flyers. Honestly, how could you at a time like this?
Well, I think you had a pretty good stab there, Beardy Man, I must say. I think we've invented an entirely new genre that the world may not yet be ready for, but they will be eventually. Perhaps you could finally just do a voiceover for the comedy club with some sort of punchy line that makes people want to listen to it all the time.
The Comedy Club, the place you'll want to listen to all the time.
Excellent.
The Comedy Club at the Edinburgh Fringe. Catch up on the Radio 4 Extra website.
Don't forget that hosting the Comedy Club all this week is John Shuttleworth. You can catch him Monday to Thursday nights at 10.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3:00 and welcome. It's Alan Smith with you here on 4 Extra, and we're about to indulge ourselves in an hour of great drama. Details coming in a minute. And in an hour from now, we've a special edition of the 4:00 show. Mel is passing the baton to presenter Hannah Conway, who'll be introducing a special proms performance from the Royal Academy of Music. Tune in for an acoustic feast at 4. Now it's time for the concluding part of the 39 steps. And hotly pursued for a notebook, Richard Hannay must evade German spies to save the British Navy.
This is Scudder's notebook. This is what he was killed for. This is why the Blackstone agents are after me.
What does it say?
I only know some of it. There's going to be a war. All Europe will be involved.
That's arrant nonsense.
Sir Walter, that's exactly the response Scudder predicted. There's more.
Go on.
The Greek Prime Minister's going to be assassinated.
Right.
And Britain's complete naval defence plans, they're going to be stolen. They'll be in Berlin by the 16th.
Show me this notebook. It's in code.
Most of it, yes. But some things are written out.
I see. This phrase is repeated 8-9 times. Obviously important. What does it mean?
I wish I knew. The 39 steps.
Mm.
The 39 Steps by John Buchan. Dramatised in two parts by Bert Cools. Episode 2. The Coming of the Black Stone.
Jameson, get the car started.
Righty-ho.
Flanders, pull out the maps. See if you can't work out his route.
Right.
No, wait. I have an idea.
I watched from the darkness of the landing as he stared up towards the guest rooms. And then his eyes suddenly hooded over and cleared again. Just like a hawk's. Scudder had called them masters of disguise, and by God, he was right. The Black Stone had found me.
Here's your change.
Thank you, my dear. I wonder, may I see our young friend's room?
But he left hours ago.
I suspect he may have left as a note.
Surely he would have left it down here with me.
Of course, stupid of me. But, you know, I'd like to be sure.
Well, let me see. He was in room 4 at the back. I'll just get the